role in living systems in biology. They were not very specific about it. They speculated. In fact, what this is a very interesting story. Niels Bohr gave a talk about light and life somewhere in UK. The audience was Max Delbruck, who was a young high energy physicist. So after listening to that talk, he decided to change his field and he became a biologist and he got Nobel Prize and so on. So Niels Bohr is supposed to have talked about the possible role of light in biology, electromagnetic radiation, quanta and so on. Similarly, Schrodinger has a book called What is Life? So he also speculates a lot, and then a major contribution of Schrodinger is that he says any genetic information should be coded in a one-dimensional chain, should be an aperiodic chain. That was his great contribution. Then people came up later, DNA structure as carrier of genetic information, and then codons and various organization. So every genetics book has Schrodinger's quote at the first page. So that was, but today I'm going to talk about something that I've been thinking for a long time, and of course now people are getting excited more every year because of some new discovery, new surprises. When we learn biology, we learn about protein, DNA, water and hydrogen bond, chemical bonds and reactions and so on. So we don't use quantum mechanics explicitly. In bonding, you know, quantum mechanics plays a role. In determining reaction rates, quantum mechanics does play a role. Then people thought that it stops there. It doesn't go beyond. But there are surprises slowly emerging in various fronts of biology. In fact, Wikipedia today found that has a nice, if you do quantum biology, Wikipedia has an extensive article referring to many quantum biology in Wikipedia. And also there are many nice references there where it is being extensively discussed, video lectures and so on. So I will start with the role of quantum magnetism in biology. In the process, I will also complete magnon condensation, spin waves, because which I left in my class, and Bogoliubov transformation will come here also. So what is the role of quantum magnetism? So this is one thing that I will talk about. Second thing is I will talk about some issue of quantum coherence in photosynthesis and about little bit about oxygen molecule O2. This is what I plan to do. So there are many corners where quantum mechanics is showing itself in biology in a surprising way. Even at wet room temperature. In fact, this is a very important point. Our body, if you go to the doctor, he will say you are okay, you are at room temperature. Your body temperature is okay. But locally, if you look at processes that are going on, they seem to be going on at absolute zero temperature. So biology seems to work hard to maintain local regions very cool and take advantage of quantum coherence. So that is a surprise that we repeatedly see. And there are many exciting developments. In fact, one of our distinguished DBRCs, Matthew Fisher, he has a theory of possible role of quantum entanglement in cognition. In fact, it was when many people speculated about it, people did not give much attention to it because it was many of them were based on speculation. What Matthew has done is very concrete. there are molecules which are involved in neurotransmission in brain functioning. And he argues that quantum entanglement of two nuclear spins of two phosphorus atoms, which is part of that Posner molecule, plays a very important role in its chemical reactions and so on. So, it acts like a qubit at room temperature. In fact, there was a talk by Nicole Halpern, please remind me the name. We talked about her. Nicola Halpern. Yeah, she gave a talk about at Perimeter. It's there in the video. She also has a book. She has also worked on this developing Matthew's idea. So, just to put it very briefly, we are at room temperature, so Boltzmann factor plays a very important role. Quantum coherence, is, you don't expect it. But however, nuclear spins, it's well known if you go to solid state physics CITEL book and read the nuclear about nuclear spins in solids, they are very weakly coupled to the environment. They are weakly coupled to the lattice vibrations. They are very weakly coupled to the electrons, conduction electrons. So, they can have their own life. They, in fact, when you do literature about study about solid state NMR, they define a lattice temperature, which can be room temperature, and a nuclear temperature, which can be very low. So, in some sense, it's a decoupled system, which is communicating very weakly with the environment, and it can have its own low temperature in very rich physics. And this is made good use of in nuclear magnetic resonance studies and so on. So, not many people suspected that this could have some implication in biology, because in our body, we have water everywhere. Now, 60% of our body is water, and water has protons. Protons carry a spin, and what do they do? And oxygen carries a spin. So, there were some ideas that since protons are weakly coupled to the environment, they could get entangled and they could maintain this quantum entanglement in this midst of this thermal bath over a long time, and it could be used. Some concrete proposal came from Klaus Schlüter some 20, 30 years ago, old friend of mine who is no more, unfortunately. He was at Urbana-Champaign. He said that nuclear spins could play a very important role in bird navigation. This is like a story, I will just before I do that. We all know that birds navigate, you know, they go fly thousands of miles in the dark, cloudy environment, no sun. So, who guides them? So, obvious answer is Earth's magnetic field. But if you look at Earth's magnetic field, its strength is very small because few Gausses, so few Kelvin in terms of g mu bh. So, in a thermal fluctuating, that will be nothing. 1 Kelvin, 2 Kelvin will be nothing. So, what is happening? So, Schlüter argued that I do not know what is going on, but at the end of the day, you have some molecule which are called biradicals, which carries 2 unpaired electrons at the end of the molecule. So, they are very weakly coupled, so that they have a singlet ground state and triplet excited state separated by few Gauss, which is like Earth's magnetic field in terms of energy unit. So, very small splitting because its 2 spins are farther away in a molecule. And of course, if you think about this system, this will decohere very quickly because of thermal fluctuations. But however, he argued that these electrons are very strong or hyperfine coupled to their corresponding nucleus. So, if I think about an entangled state of electron spin, it can be easily transferred to the entangled state of nuclear spins. And then once nuclear spins are entangled, they do not give it up. They get remain entangled for minutes and seconds and so on. So, he said this could be a role, key role in the following sense. So, it turns out depending on the spin state of the molecule, the reaction moves this way or it reaction moves in another way. So, if it starts with a triplet state, there are biochemical reactions which takes you in one way. In a triplet singlet state, it goes in another way. So, that is the beginning of a detailed process of recognition of the magnetic field. So, that was a key idea of Klaus Schlüter, which was originally received with skepticism, and so now it is almost proved experimentally. In fact, I had the pleasure of sitting with him in one conference when the confirmation was presented. So, in a very subtle way, since nuclear spins are very weakly coupled, biology could make use of it in quantum entanglement.
Okay.
So that is the one of the beautiful developments, and there are many, many such instances. Olfaction, I will come to it later. Smell, there is a quantum mechanics there. Then similarly, in many enzyme activity, vision and so on. So, inspired by many of these things, long back in 2002, in fact, I will request Emily to put that article in the our site. I was playing with it and found that I made a hypothesis that all basic notions and phenomena in that we see in condensed matter physics mirror in biology. That was my hypothesis, and gave few examples. My point was very simple. We human beings have been doing science for the last 500 years, maybe modern science, or few 300 years. We have advanced enormously, but biology had 3 billion years of time. So it has explored all things that it has created, life out of atoms and molecules. So it should be making use of condensed matter physics principles. It must have discovered many of these things in the past. So there must be instances where it closely resembles what you see in condensed matter phenomena. So a natural question will be, people will ask, where is superconductivity? So my answer there was, yes, there is no superconductivity as far as I know. But however, there is magnon condensation, which is like a BEC condensation. And if you look at the mathematics of it, it looks like it has Bogoliubov transformation and everything. So at the level of mathematics and the level of off-diagonal long range, the level of quantum coherence, it is there. Some people have speculated there may be local superconductivity, but I don't believe that because we're too speculative. But these are very concrete. So that takes me to the role of magnetism in biology. So it appears like this. See, we all need iron in our life, plants, any living being. So we need, sometimes we have excess ions. So often these ions are kept in a beautiful way as iron oxide and covered by some protein coat. They are called ferritin. So they are protein complexes at the center of which their ions are stored in the form of iron oxide, which also contains some water molecule. So typically you have about 4 to 5,000 ion atoms in this core. And if you look at the ground state of that, and that iron oxide has an ideal temperature of 800 Kelvin, very high temperature, it's a very strongly coupled system. And then when people do experiments, they find this is a beautiful monodomain antiferromagnet or ferrimagnet. Let me, monodomain ferromagnet. Monodomain means there are no, everybody is beautifully ordered and there is a quantum fluctuation going on. And then it has interesting consequences. It has interesting, and people always worried, what is it doing? What is quantum magnetism doing? Quantum antiferromagnetism, ferrimagnetism. Turns out, as we saw, they have excitations like magnon collective modes, like Bogoliubov quasi particle excitations, and they help in electron transfer reactions. So if you want to do quantitatively, you have to invoke Bogoliubov transformation, calculate magnon energy at room temperature, and then use it. And then there are even more subtle roles envisaged in these things. So I will do that, take that opportunity to do spin wave theory in a quantum mechanical way. This is something that I should have done long back. I did not do it. So if I want to understand an antiferromagnet and a ferromagnet from boson point of view, bosonic excitation, how do we do it? This is a question that you asked. Suppose I have a ferromagnet, then the Hamiltonian, I take the simple isotropic Heisenberg Hamiltonian. It could be cubic lattice, for example. And this problem is not solvable. It's solvable for the ground state. You can convincingly show that all spins pointing in one direction is the ground state. There are no, however, we don't know about excitation spectrum except in one dimension. In one dimension, Bethe-Ansatz solution gives you exact solutions. Whereas in two dimension, we have approximate theory. That is where the spin wave theory and what is called Hallstein-Primakov transformation or spin wave theory comes. So it was recognized by Hallstein and Primakov, I think independently, that a spin operator, a ladder operator, can be written as something like this. So, you know, these are all, suppose I take spin half, I have Pauli spin operator, then there are two levels. But imagine that you have a harmonic oscillator locally, which has infinite number of equispace levels. Then you want to restrict your physics somehow into the lowest level. You want to do it because you use this Hilbert space, then make sure that you don't use the rest of the Hilbert space often. Because it's an approximation, using this full Hilbert space gives you facility in terms of commutation relation analysis very conveniently. This is the spirit of Hallstein-Primakov approximation, that you can rewrite spin operator like this for any s. Like, for example, s equal to half, you will have half minus a dagger a and so on. Then, you know, when you, yeah, okay, I will not go into the detail. So, now you can imagine expanding in powers of 1 over s, because, for example, you can pull out this s and then expand it, keep the leading term. So, when you do that, si plus becomes ai. Okay. So, basically, this becomes like an annihilation operator. That means, you think about a downspin, what is the convention? Let me write down. So, for example, SI is at up will correspond to 0 occupancy. A I dagger A is 0, so S is half. And then SI, A I dagger A equal to 1 will correspond to minus. So, that's a convention. So, if the spin is up, you call it as a boson with occupancy 1. If the spin is down, you call it a boson with occupancy 1. So, if in terms of boson language, you can keep going up 2, 3 and so on. But for, you want to ignore this, because you will find that when you do analysis with this approximation, these higher states of the harmonic oscillator do not really participate at low temperature. So, it is a good approximation. So, when you take this approximation and substitute in the Hamiltonian, you can very easily show that it becomes, I will not go into the details, a very simple mathematics, J that is, you can, like, you know, when you write this, it will look like S I dagger plus, there is a x y part can be written as S plus S minus, then you have the S Z part also. You will find in this problem S Z does not play much role because everybody is polarized. So, this alone will tell you that if there is a spin flip configuration, this term will push it around. So, they will quantum delocalize. So, that is how quantum fluctuations come. And it turns out, this what I have written is the elementary excitation in local space, then you form block states. So, if you look at gamma k is 1 over z e to the power of y k dot delta, where delta is a nearest neighbor vector. Suppose I have a simple cubic lattice, I have a site I have 6 neighbors. So, I have these small vectors pointing on the 6 directions, and that is this. So, you can immediately see and look at it and expand it, you will find that this is proportional to k a whole square at small momenta. So, immediately you find that the magnons in ferromagnet behaves like some coefficient so you can start calling it as like h cross square k square by 2 m star a k. So, magnon excitations behave like quantum particle with some effective mass m. Now, if you take a well-known ferromagnet like magnetite and other things, and you put the numbers, this is like 10 times or 20 times heavier than electron. So they are quasi-heavy quasi-particles, which are bosons. So they have a dispersion like this. For a ferromagnet, excitation energy as a function of Q. So this follows from this Hallstein-Primakov analysis. Now, once you keep higher order terms, which I have ignored, then there will be magnon-magnon interaction. Yes.
I don't think I fully understand the spin wave approximation. Like, if this weren't the spin 1/2 state, but instead like some spin 2 state or something, then you would want to, like, it wouldn't just be like successive rungs of like the Hilbert space.
Correct.
Like, ignore some. Like, how does that work in the?
So the idea is the following. So it is true that when I use boson operators, I have a boson occupancy of 0, 1, 2, and so up to infinity. But as far as my spin is concerned, there are only two states. So as if only these two states are relevant. So what I find is, if I close my eyes and then continue to use a boson operator, I am not doing something wrong. As far as ground state is concerned, I am only using this. So that's fine. Then if you look at low energy excitation, I use only this. So if I go to higher order, then I will have terms in which I use this. Then I should be careful. Then it turns out they have higher energy, so they're automatically suppressed. So this is an approximation. So in that sense, spin wave is a good approximation at low temperature. Now, when I heat the system, there will be domain walls and many, many things. So then the spin waves will very strongly interact, and all these approximations will fail. So I use spin wave quantum approximation in a well-ordered system as low energy excitations.
Wait, but this system, it wouldn't be at low temperature, would it? Would it be like? Is this system at low temperature? Is it at room temperature or something?
Low temperature.
Okay.
Low temperature, exactly. So then the question of what is low temperature is depends on the parameter. It turns out for the magnet that I am talking about in biology, room temperature is a low temperature because it's a very hard magnet. The transition real temperature is 800-900 Kelvin. So it is okay to use the approximation. So this is, here you notice that excitations are magnons, ground state has no magnons. Okay. This looks like some ideal Bose gas with some, you know, with no chemical potential, but unlike photon where the dispersion is linear, here it's called quadratic. So it can be thought of, suppose I take a finite temperature ferromagnet, I can think of it as an ideal Bose gas with zero chemical potential, except that the Bose particles have quadratic dispersion at low momentum, unlike photon, which has linear momentum at low at any energy. But however, it's a boson, and you can, so this approximation works very well. And then you can look at finite temperature corrections and so on, and calculate specific heat. It has very beautiful consequences. All of this has been discussed in Kittel. Now comes antiferromagnet. So suppose, you know, this is, nature has given us some ferromagnet. Many of them are mostly antiferromagnet. An antiferromagnet, for example, if you take a spin, the ground state, if you think of classical spins, are like this, because the J is plus. J is greater than 0. Then you can think of, convince yourself that if you think of as classical vectors, the system will be happy if the two spins point in opposite direction, in neighbors. So this is an antiferromagnet. Then what do I do with this? Then one can look at it and then imagine deriving a ferromagnet from an antiferromagnet by flipping alternate spins. That means I take a ferromagnet and create n by 2 magnons, quanta, and then freeze them. So you can, with reference to a ferromagnet, it can be thought of as a highly excited state, which becomes a ground state of this. But then it turns out this is not an eigenstate. This is what I was telling last time. Because if we take this particular state, even a two-site example, if you act with this 1 and 2, you will find that it leads to also this combination plus. So it is not, it cannot, so this is a quantum fluctuation. So when you act with the Hamiltonian, there will be quantum fluctuations. Now I want to control that and treat it. So I use, go back to Holstein-Primakov theory and do it. Now I should be careful because this is called semi-classical analysis. What I do is, I think about this as a ground state and then create boson operators with this reference state. So for example, you will appreciate it. To me, I take two sites, that is sublattice A and sublattice B, which I denote by A and B. Then I say, in other words, here if I use the same old reference frame, here flipping this spin will be creating a local magnon, local boson. Here annihilating will be creating a local boson because it's down. So if I do that and just follow the algebra, you'll start seeing what we did in Bogolyubov theory. What you will find is you'll have terms like this. I will just briefly indicate this. You notice this is like a hopping, like in a ferromagnet. But however, I have this term which tells you if this spin configuration can become this, I can pair annihilate or pair disappear. So now it looks like Bogolyubov theory that we did for bosons, interacting bosons. So I do Bogolyubov transformation. What I get is, I will again, because of time and many things I wanted to say, you get a beautiful dispersion like this, something like this. You will have spin waves at the appropriate k point, which are collective modes. They are called the magnons. They have linear dispersion in this system. So the mathematics is just Bogolyubov transformation. So here you can, with respect to the ferromagnet, you can think of as a magnon condensation. Normally, magnon condensation takes place at zero momentum. Here, because they are spatially ordered, it corresponds to pi-pi momentum. It corresponds to wave vector, which is at the Brillouin zone corner. Sorry, I don't have time to explain that, but you can check with Kittel. So this is the beautiful thing. So if I want to understand ferritin, and if you want to understand electron transfer, I have to do a quantum mechanical calculation, it turns out. And at room temperature, if you take ferritin, because the energies are high, not many magnons are excited. And it is believed this ferritin helps in electron transfer, and it assists this quanta gets excited and it's absorbed by the electron that is getting transferred. I will come to it in some detail. So you note, so my, here I, in my paper, I will give the reference out later. I will also put it in the website, in our site. You need to, in order to quantitatively understand what's going on, a very important process in biology, you have to have Bogolyubov transformation, you have to understand magnons and quantum. So in that sense, off-diagonal and long-range order comes. Now, people have gone some step beyond, and many people have speculated, this magnetic moment macroscopically can tunnel from one configuration to another configuration, even at room temperature. So you can even have Schrodinger cat-like state in a warm, wet environment. But those things I'm not familiar with. There are some controversy. But the point is, the elementary processes involve a study of boson condensation. This is point number one. Okay, so this is just, I give you just a glimpse of this thing. Now the next thing is, I will go to photosynthesis, quantum coherence in photosynthesis. This is amazing that, you know, we see, it's now spring, we see green and colorful. So where are the colors? We know sunlight is, you know, helping us, and we are, life is formed because of that and so on. So what is the elementary act of photosynthesis? So in photosynthesis, you know, photon gets absorbed and then there is water separation and oxygen and all, there is a detailed process which we are not interested in. But what is the elementary process? The elementary process corresponds to a quantum mechanical absorption of light by a single photon by a chromophore or a chlorophyll molecule, because sun has a spectrum of the, and depending on the every photosynthetic system has many, many molecules which absorb some selective range. Now, if I go to this photosynthesis, I do not know how many of you have seen the picture of photosynthetic apparatus in your, have you come across that? How these absorbing molecules are organized? Okay. So, the whole community is surprised, and they gave Nobel Prize to the person who discovered many, many years ago. There are molecules which are called chromophores or chlorophyll type of molecules, which absorb specific range of radiation, and then they get excited. And this, you know, is a molecular exciton. An excited state of a molecule is called an exciton. You have not ionized the molecule. Then this exciton energy has to be used in some chemical reaction. So, what nature has done is, there is something called reaction center, and then there are what I show schematically are some kind of planar molecule, typically with magnesium and other things at the end. There are benzene like rings and so on, and they are organized in a circular disk, specific number 36 and 18, and they are held by complex of proteins. So, this is a schematic picture of a very complex protein aggregation, very specific aggregation, in which there are, let us say in this case, about 18 chlorophylls or which are light absorbing molecule. So, a photon falls and gets absorbs. Then you know quantum mechanically, it is a quantum object, it would like to spread, it would like to hop around, and it does hop through what is called Froster mechanism. This I will not go into the details. So, it is like an excited state. So, there are fluctuating dipole moment which will cause this excitation to go from here to here. So, it is understandable. It happens in solids. For example, if I take diamond and by light create a particle hole pair excitation, I create a particle and hole pair locally, and they are bound and they move quantum mechanically with some effective mass. What was thought before was, they thought this exciton will run, because it is an energy packet, incoherently, and then it will pass its radiation to what is called a reaction center, which will initiate a cascade of events. Now, the first surprise was that when they found the disk structure and they started doing, making this synthetically and found out many surprises, that this exciton, that excited state I have created, runs around coherently in laboratory time scale, which they never, because they thought thermal fluctuations, other things will make them decohere, but they run beautifully coherently. In fact, there is a group in Toronto, not far from here, I think his name is Professor Eccles, and they are pioneers in this field. They have done wonderful work on, they were one of the early people to talk about quantum coherence. Now, once you talk about quantum coherence, things like entanglement becomes an obvious thing. So, are they entangled? And are they playing a role in biology? This is still an active field, but the fact is experimentally confirmed that there is quantum coherent motion of this exciton over scales which are much larger than, you know, 10 nanometers, like 100 nanometer. So, they happily run around. Then not only that, then there are other sister photosynthetic apparatus organized beautifully. They have 16 or something like that. There's called, one is called LH1, another is called light harvesting complex 2, and so on. And they get the photon and they transfer it. So, there is a whole organization of network of this thing. So, they implicate the role of quantum entanglement, but it's far from understanding. But now, in the last 10-15 years, important developments have convinced that biology keeps locally cool, where it's very cool, and takes advantage of quantum, creates quantum coherent states. Okay. What I got very excited about it when I first read about it is this. So, you know that suppose you take a hydrogen atom, you can create an excitation, go to 1s to 2s, or 2, typically you do this, you have dipole excitation. Because you have a non-zero matrix, you go from 1s to 2s. So this excitation preserves the spin, because the spin doesn't change when there is a transition. But when you take molecules like this, because of spin orbit coupling, so typically the statement is that if you take a molecule and shine light on it, you get a excited state, which is also a spin singlet. So you say it's a triplet exciton or it's a singlet exciton. So you shine light, it gets excited. It is a singlet exciton. And then that runs around coherently, and the energy is transferred, and reaction center initiates an electron transfer, and many, many things happen. But what was found was, because the systems have heavy atoms, with some probability, the spin need not be conserved, so you can create a triplet exciton. So what is a triplet exciton? It's like a hole, an electron. So in a singlet, you think, you say that they form a spin singlet state and they dance around. In a triplet, you can imagine up spin. So normally, in the absence of spin orbit coupling, this is not allowed. This is forbidden. But spin orbit coupling allows for spin flip, because spin is not a conserved number, quantum number. What is conserved is J. So you get a triplet. Now, it turns out triplet is very bad in biology. So evolution and biology has learned it over billions of years. Why? Because of the following thing. I do not know how many of you know, what is the spin state of oxygen molecule? I always ask this question. What is the spin state? Oxygen molecule has even number of electrons, because O2. So what, even if it had odd number, so it is. So what do you think is a spin state? Spin 1. So normally, like if you take hydrogen molecule, there are 2 electrons and they form a beautiful singlet. If you take N2, nitrogen molecule, which is part of air, whereas oxygen has spin 1. This was discovered by Faraday and others also, because liquid oxygen, Faraday. So if you take liquid oxygen and take a bar magnet, it gets pulled towards the magnet, because liquid oxygen has, oxygen molecules have spins, so they get polarized, so they can be attracted to a magnet. And this has profound implications in our biology. We are able to breathe and we are able to live because of that oxygen is a triplet. How? Because we know we breathe, the oxygen that we breathe in gets transferred all over the body through hemoglobin protein. In hemoglobin, oxygen is kept in some place by iron atom. So there are places where oxygen is trapped, and then this hemoglobin moves through the blood and then delivers it in various places. So this spin triplet state of oxygen is very fundamental. That's why nature in evolution has found it convenient to, because then only it can be carried. If it were a singlet, it's difficult to carry it. Since it is a triplet, the iron atom in that part of that hemoglobin molecule attaches it. And there are also beautiful cooperative phenomena. I will not go into it. In fact, that's a tiny bit of 6-site icing model if you want to do it. In quantum chemistry, people have used it. There is also quantum tunneling. I will not go into the detail. Okay. Now, how is it connected to this triplet exciton? Then it turns out, if you have a triplet exciton, if an oxygen comes and in close proximity to it, then the 2 triplet will combine to become a singlet oxygen. So it will transfer some energy and excite the oxygen into a singlet state. Then it turns out singlet oxygen is very deadly for biology. Wherever it goes, it will deliver the energy, it breaks the bonds. So nature has found a way of getting rid of singlet oxygen that is occasionally produced through this singlet triplet exciton that has produced, by a very clever mechanism, which is the following. So I have written this, suppose I take a side view of this, then I have a chromophore. Then it turns out, each one of them has some side group hanging, which is our friendly polyacetylene, which we discussed in the last class. How does polyacetylene, this is where work by Schlutten and others come. So I have an exciton running around. Then I have a triplet exciton produced because of spin orbit coupling, but very rarely. then that has to be killed, that has to be removed, because any oxygen that is coming, if it comes in contact with the triplet exciton, it will get excited and it will become singlet and then it's bad. So what nature seems to have done is the following. That triplet exciton gets transferred, that energy gets transferred to polyacetylene. And we know polyacetylene, if you create, transfer this, that will correspond to breaking a singlet bond into a triplet bond. Because it was a singlet, this spin one is transferred here. So, I have effectively the exciton has disappeared and also I have created an excited state here. Now, what is this? This is a triplet. But it turns out, because of what we saw, quantum number of fractionization, after some time, one unpaired spin is here, another unpaired spin is, they move away. Now, this is not harmful for oxygen because it's an innocent spin hop. So, look at it, biology has used it in such a profound way, it has, through evolution, it has done SSH model and it has created solitons and it takes care of triplet excitons that are occasionally produced, which are poisonous from the point of view I mentioned, and then through the physics that we learned in the previous classes, domain wall. So, you take a polyacetylene, create a triplet excitation, I told you that it breaks into two spin solitons. So, this happens. It's amazing. So, how nature makes use of what we have discovered recently in its day-to-day affair. This is one thing. I talk a little bit about it. Then, in my paper, which I will give the reference, I talk about fermion condensation of these excitons. Because we have learned in the about Jordan-Weig transport. Suppose I have one-dimensional system, a boson is as good as a fermion if there is some short-range repulsion. So, whenever excitons, many of them are absorbed, then they have a short-range repulsion. Then if I model it, it becomes like 1D Fermi system. So, there is fermionization. Then once here they become fermions, they refuse to give the energy to the reaction center complex. There are consequences. So, what we learned in the class can be used in biology. So, this is one thing. So, what did I want to do? Yeah. Yeah, the next thing that I will talk about is, yeah, the phonon assisted tunneling. This is something I will schematically point out what it is, and then we can, because that's where the role of magnon and some quantum physics in olefaction also come. You all heard about tunneling. Suppose you have a barrier, let's say you have a metal here with some Fermi level, or a molecule, there are series of occupied states. Let's say there is an electron, then there is a big barrier, and if there is another level which is empty, this electron can tunnel. This will be called resonant tunneling, like quantum mechanical tunneling you learn in class. And it's well known that this regularly happens in biology over long distance. In fact, there is a whole group of people working on long distance electron transfer in DNA. In DNA, there are mutations and many things going on, life-threatening processes. They are repaired by long distance electron transfer. I was introduced to it when I was a PhD student by a friend of mine who was a biochemist. That's the advantage of being in a university. You have friends who are biologists and so on. He introduced me to a book by Saint Georgi. He happens to be a Nobel laureate in biology. Saint Georgi. So, he talks about quantum processes involving long distance electron transfer. So, okay. So, this will be called resonant tunneling. In fact, when people doing quantum dots and so on, they do tunneling. Similarly, tunneling between two metals or a metal and a semiconductor or a superconductor, Josephson tunneling, it is well known. Because there is a barrier and the quantum mechanics allows for leaking and quantum tunneling, which we learned very well. Now, there are situations in which the energy levels may be offset. For example, it may be the energy level may be here. So, the empty level that is available is at some scale, let us say it is called, let me call it as h cross omega naught. So, often the the barrier can be thought of as some kind of molecule. So there are molecular vibrations, and they have quantum phonon quanta, and that quanta can be used in doing a resonant tunneling. It's called phonon assisted tunneling, because when you do your quantum mechanics of this, this phonon, because if you do a scattering process, you have an electron goes to another state by absorbing a phonon. So like a, so there is a matrix element for this. So here I have a localized state, goes to another excited state, but there is a matrix element for phonon excitation or absorption. This is well known. In fact, people have done it in quantum dots and in tunneling between a metal and semiconductor, phonon assisted tunneling. Now, how does it help us? So then this is where this quantum physics of smell. So somebody smelled quantum mechanics there. So what you have is, we smell. Now we can smell different type of odors. If it turns out, if you go into the details of the smelling phenomena, each smell is correct, is connected to a specific molecule. A specific molecule which has a particular shape and content and so on. And the process of smelling corresponds to an enzyme which catches that molecule. It's like a lock and key. So this enzyme can only capture that particular molecule, not others. So they get fit. Then what happens? People knew that once this happens, it triggers an electron transfer reaction, quantum tunneling. And then that cascades of event makes us finally feel the smell. So this is the initial step, like in many of these. We are talking about the initial step. Then it was found, I do not know why they did it. Somebody said, let me take this molecule and replace some of the atoms by its isotope. So I make, let's say, carbon by carbon 13 and so on. Then they found that smell is disappeared. So that was a surprise. So that's where Luca Turin came. In fact, I also met him in a meeting. He was at MIT. I don't know where he is now. So he said, okay, that means there is a phonon assisted tunneling. It is true that a particular molecule comes and sits here and immediately triggers an electron transfer, but that molecule supplies a phonon quanta also. So you need to have a phonon assisted tunneling. Now, once you replace it by a heavier atom or a lighter atom, then the, you know, omega is 1 over this comes into play, the frequency, typically the inverse scale, tells you that you have not the right phonon frequency. So resonant tunneling is suppressed. So you notice at the room wet temperature, quantum tunneling comes in a beautiful way. This was the suggestion. Now, only recently I learned that this is also happening in the case of ferritin. So there is a magnon assisted tunneling. Here you have phonon assisted tunneling. There it's a spin wave assisted tunneling. And these are all just the beginning. So there are many, many things I can keep on enumerating, but I think I will stop here today at least 5 minutes earlier and then have a discussion with you. So this is, you know, there are many other quantum matters, you know, as I, there are, you know, people like Roger Penrose, who was a DB, I have seen him, he was a DBS here, he's a Nobel laureate and so on, so he can afford to speculate. So he talks about quantum origin of consciousness and so on, and microtubules at qubits. See, we think of superconducting qubits if you go to, or we think of ion trap qubits, we went to the lab. But to Penrose, microtubules are some tubular organizations of proteins which are very important in cells. They are like skeletal network of inside the cell, and they become cavity modes which become qubits. And then lots and lots of interesting ideas have been there. And then the people are skeptical about some of them, many things are getting proved. So lots and lots of things are there in the field. So I think I will close here. And so please send an email to me, or I am here till the middle of July. Catch me anytime to talk about any of the topics that I think whatever I spoke was sufficiently vague, so there is opportunity for you to learn it better. And so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Question. Because I've not seen much condensed matter field theory, so I don't know anything about these things. But a lot of the models that we've studied, it feels like very much like, you know, bread and butter quantum mechanics. Like,
yeah, sure.
Operators and stuff like this, but not fields. Are there models, like what would be an example of a quantum matter model that you can't really analyze from this perspective, where it's just like nice, like operators and position and momentum as operators and block wave functions and stuff like this? Like what's a quantum matter system where you would need a field theory to study it?
So what in the biological context or in general?
In general,
as I told you, for example, there is a model called a Hubbard model, which has been in the central scene, which describes strongly correlated systems like motor insulators, antiferromagnets, high temperature superconductors. So people study it. So a well-defined model, a lattice model, you can think of it as lattice of qubits. Now the qubit states corresponds to one electron being there with up or down spin, or two electrons with zero spin or no electron. So people have done detailed quantum simulations, even cold atom people and so on, they have tried to simulate it and getting a lot of new insights. Similarly, there is a model called, in fact, one of the friendly models I wanted to do was Sachdev Kitaev model. In fact, I didn't have time. That's a very friendly model in the sense you can solve it analytically. Asymptotic physical properties can be inferred. Now, according to Kitaev, that model exemplifies what is going on inside the black hole. So, it came from condensed matter and it's extremely popular model and many, many insights have come. And also it tries to, people try to understand some of the properties of normal state of cuprates using that model. So, condensed quantum matter physics is full of models, many, many friendly models, unfriendly models. And there are also, you know, one of the advantages of looking at these models is, this is something I should point out. There is phenomenon, you must have been familiar with eigenstate thermalization. The beautiful hypothesis Schrodinger made many, many years ago. If you look at many body eigenstates, the eigenstates of a particle, and pick up a random eigenstate at high energy, it is a pure state. But if you look at part of it locally by integrating over the rest, the thing becomes like a density matrix, a thermal density matrix with a temperature corresponding to where the state is in the energy axis. So, instead of doing microcanonical ensemble or canonical ensemble, you can do this one state analysis locally. Now, this is called eigenstate thermalization hypothesis, which is typically there. But recently, people have found out that if you take some of these model Hamiltonians, there are exceptions to this. You may go to very high temperature and then take they are called quantum scars. I call them quantum beauties, not scars, you know, because scars are beautiful here. Because you pick them up and do this analysis, they never become thermal. So they are very different. They behave like some kind of exotic ground states. So then immediately you can jump and say that means if you can produce that excited states, and it can protect itself in the thermal environment. And it can be used as a qubit, natural qubit. So, is biology doing that? There are big questions. So, model Hamiltonians shows these new windows also, quantum scars. There are many, many simple models. Like there is a famous model called PXP Hamiltonian. That's the name. It's a very simple, well-defined using Rydberg atom arrays. There again, these quantum scars are there. And there are attempts to use excited state, because normally you say the quantum mechanics is at work in the ground state or close to it. But here it says quantum mechanics can work even at very high excited state, non-equilibrium states. In other words, in the world of non-equilibrium phenomena, there can be quantum coherence. And many people believe they are playing a role in biology, because biology is full of non-equilibrium. So it's a regulated state wherein you pump energy, keep doing things, and then so there won't be, I won't be surprised that they find qubits like that. So does it answer your question? Yeah.
Well, I think what's part of your question about microscopic models versus working in the continuum with field theories?
Yeah, or but I guess I'm just wondering if you're working with field theories and like seeing, because like I know Rokas talks a lot about like, oh yeah, these things are CFTs, like we have to but I've never really properly seen the computations. So like just like models like this, that's what.
Yeah, and if there's a model in field theory or in the continuum that you don't, I mean, you would use it, you need a different regulator. In a way, these are all field theories, we're just regulating on the lattice. But I think also with Rokas's, with RGs, you can get the
yes.
RG perspective.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I think we have that a bit lucid for like
In fact, you can, you know, it's following what Emily said, there are these lattice models, but if you look at sufficiently low energies, they start, in depending on the problem, they start looking at SU2 gauge theory.
Mm-hmm.
So they are emergent degree of freedom. We have some iron up fermion. So Chern-Simons field theories emerge, non-abelian gauge fields emerge, non-abelian anions emerge. So in that sense, the continuum field theory, please continue, no problem. Continuum field theory perspective is very useful because the Hilbert space is too big, they focus on the ground state corner, and that looks like a beautiful effective theory, which is sometimes string theory. There are situations in quantum matter which if you want to do the effective theory, looks like a string theory. You won't believe helium 4 atom. If you look at it in some language, it's a quantum string field theory. What are the strings? The strings are closed vertices which are quantum mechanically generated, unthermally generated, and they interact amongst, they become effective degree of freedom. So, in that sense, the effective field theories are very powerful coming from simple models. They go to them, like some of these inflationary issues can be discussed in effective theories model. And analog gravity, you know, like my Akbar Jafari from Iran, he has been working on graphene-like system with a tilted graph, Dirac cone is tilted, then he sees event horizon-like phenomena. So, effective field theory is very rich, they take you completely, in fact, many years ago, I gave a talk saying that condensed matter physics is a lab of quantum field theory. You can realize anything that you want. And even more, because for high energy physics, Lorentz invariance is a must. But we can break Lorentz invariance very happily. Like we can have a situation in which velocity of light is anisotropic. That can be realized. So many things like that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
What would you say are? I mean, today you outlined some of the various topics from quantum biology. What would you say are topics that you know have really been around for a long time versus ones that maybe right now are becoming a thing?
For example, there is a proposal by Matthew Fisher about the model for quantum cognition. It's a very beautiful quantum phenomena coming from nuclear spin and entanglement with rotational degree of freedom. You may like to look at it because it's a very exciting development. Lots of new works are coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Just to give a concrete because it's a whatever that it's very non-trivial and beautiful. It involves how rotational degree of freedom. You know, for example, suppose you take hydrogen molecule. The hydrogen molecule remembers what is the state of the proton spins. The proton spins can form a singlet or a triplet, right? Because they are very weakly coupled. But however, the rotational state, because of antisymmetry requirement, is selected depending on the spin state. For example, you know, the whole system should be anti-symmetric. Then that forces certain angular moment, rotational state. So similar things is invoked by Matthew Fisher in enzymatic reaction. And he estimates consequences, which people are following and experimentally trying to. So that's one. Recently, there is a lot of hype about it. But there are many, many small corners like photosynthesis, olefaction. There is a lot of room for new development, yeah. I always encourage young people to just keep an eye on it, yeah. And similarly, I didn't have time to talk about the vision problem. You know, our eyes also detect like photosynthetic apparatus. Single photons is the beginning of our vision, single photon absorption. So it's a quantum mechanical phenomena. And also apparently our eyes are capable of detecting even single photon. This is also a recent development, and now the people have become greedy and they are asking, can it detect entangled photon? And so the first discoverer of this or proposer was famous Lawrence, early last century. Somebody went to him saying that somebody who does experiments with in vision, they were looking at the patients to look at light, then reduce the intensity of the light. They stopped seeing at a particular intensity suddenly. So it's like a sharp transition. They came and reported that to Lawrence. Lawrence made an estimate, oh, that means it's the number of photons falling in your eye is about 40 per second. Then he conjectured, maybe our eyes are capable of detecting single photons. This was before photons became very popular. Then C.V. Raman also independently. Now people confirm that our eyes are able to, with some 10% probability, single photon. And our friend cockroach, you know, this insect, that lives by detecting single photon because it lives in dark environment. So it is, so its life is single photon. So quantum biology is there.
Thank you.
Okay, all the best.